coming up on today's program.
They were playing harmonica and some bells that they had actually sneaked on board for their trip throughout the atmosphere. And they claimed to see some sort of vehicle flying from north to south in space and someone in a red suit flying it. And then they played Jingle Bells.
The history of Christmas carols. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. Later in our program, we'll hear from Caitlin Schrader, WISO's digital editor, about some of the top stories that WISO listeners tuned into this year. We've also got Today from the Ohio Newsroom and Bird Note to wrap up our program. Up first, let's dive right in on those Christmas carols which have been written and sung and enjoyed or even panned by listeners for centuries. And there's a rich history to the secular and non-secular carols and songs that have evolved in that time. To get a Tiny Tim-sized taste of that history, we spoke with University of Dayton professor Randall Wolf, who teaches a class on the subject and is the author of a book called Music of Christmas, Around the World, Through the Centuries, and in American Popular Music.
Initially, carols were circle dances in the Middle Ages. They were secular or sacred music. They were not even necessarily Christmas music. And over the centuries, they became more and more known to be sacred music that might be performed in church, but not necessarily liturgical. So the music itself of a carol tends to be a little bit simpler in nature and uses the vernacular language of each country rather than the Latin of the ecclesiastical church. So throughout the centuries, I think there's been this fluid movement back and forth, starting with St. Francis and his nativities, his live nativities in the cave back in the 1220s, I believe, where he had live animals and also sang carols, even at a mass. So we go all the way to the 20th century where Bing Crosby starts recording carols and suddenly Silent Night becomes something that is heard in the secular world. He didn't want to record it at first. He thought it belonged in church. But his brother convinced him to give the proceeds to an orphanage in China to poor children there, where he was already doing some work to help them raise money.
Do you have any other favorite stories from your book about specific carols?
Some of my favorite carols to present to the class are those of the outlying countries on other continents. For example, there are some carols that have actually been composed in Antarctica with some scientists. Nick Sterinsky is a nuclear physicist who produced a song called Blues Before Christmas. He played his guitar, and the bluesy sound sort of, I think, maybe reflects what it's like to be in Antarctica around Christmas time. There are also some examples of music played in outer space. The first piece, I think, was played on Gemini 6 by Wally Schirra and Thomas Stafford. They were playing harmonica and some bells that they had actually sneaked on board for their trip throughout the atmosphere. And they claimed to see some sort of vehicle flying from north to south in space and someone in a red suit flying it, and then they play Jingle Bells.
There are carols that people associate with Christmas that aren't generally or specifically Christmas related.
Yes, in fact, Jingle Bells depicts going through the snow in a sleigh and was originally a Thanksgiving song. In fact, I think it was called the One Horse Open Sleigh at first. There are other carols celebrated as Christmas carols, such as Winter Wonderland and Deck the Halls, which simply welcome the season. In fact, Deck the Halls was a Welsh New Year's Day carol, and a lot of people will put Ave Maria on recordings when they drop their recordings today in their sets of Christmas songs. It really celebrates the Annunciation of Mary in March, so there are quite a few carols that didn't start out as Christmas carols but are kind of accepted in that format today.
Were there any big surprises that you learned in doing research for your book?
Yes, I think I spent more time researching the 12 Days of Christmas than any other carol. There is a Catholic tradition that the 12 days represent different tenets of the Catholic faith during a time that England was suppressing the Catholic faith. And I did a lot of research and finally came to the conclusion that that's probably not true that the song was really traced back to a French song that was a counting song. It was a game for children to see if they could remember all the different components of the song. And it's okay that some of these songs take on religious meanings or secular meanings for sacred carols.
I love this about your book. It looks like you've got 200 plus links to audio and video of some of the songs that you're talking about, correct?
Yes, there are 200 links, many of them on YouTube, and I've selected particular performers to try to have a complete range of different genres. I think our playlists in America tend to be maybe 50 carols on a given station, and there are at least 4,500 carols at a particular website, hymnsandcarolsofchristmas.com. I think it's important to get a feel for what Christmas is like around the world.
Dr. Randall Wolf is the author of Music of Christmas Around the World Through the Centuries and in American Popular Music. Dr. Wolf, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it, and happy holidays.
Michael Vandenberg has stepped down as executive director after 8 years at St. Vincent de Paul Society of Dayton. Angie Grillo will lead the local faith-based nonprofit in the interim. A committee will kick off the search for a new executive director to oversee the nonprofit's $14 million budget for 2026. WISO's Shea Frank sat down with Vandenberg to learn more about what's next for him and the community he's served for nearly a decade.
So what got you involved with working with St. Vincent de Paul of Dayton?
Well, it's a faith-based ministry, and I'm a faith-based person, and I've worked in faith-based ministries for many decades, and I've grown a fondness for people who are outcast and people who are separated from the deep relationships in their lives and who need a concerning person to be in front of them.
So what were your responsibilities as the executive director of this organization?
So over that period, we had about anywhere from 120 to 160 full-time employees. And we had about 1,000 active volunteers in the community. For most of that time, we ran two very large homeless shelters 24/7. And we also have about 150 or so men, women, and children in supportive housing. And then we have about 30 what we call conferences across the Miami Valley, whose volunteers help keep people stable in their homes and who run food pantries and who do clothing assistance and utility assistance, rent assistance, and connecting people to other resources in the community, again, to keep them stable. So my role was to kind of be the ringleader of all of that and provide the resources and provide the people to do the work.
So tell me about some of the highlights of the work that you've done while you were in those 8 years with St. Vincent.
I got about a year under my belt before things got a little crazy with first the Memorial Day tornadoes and then the Oregon District shooting and then the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a trifecta of real trauma to the community where the Society of St. Vincent de Paul was ready to assist. But I think the most enduring experience from that was building relationships where we could count on one another that really became helpful when the pandemic came. We also saw, as a result of the pandemic, just like in other areas of the country, a lot of government funding that became available. Unfortunately, that also created some inflationary pressures. And in the last couple of years, we've really seen that the effects of that with the funding running out, but the costs still being high.
Tell me about why you've decided to depart from your role as executive director with St. Vincent de Paul.
This past year in particular for me has been a very traumatic year. I've had some deaths in my family, multiple mm-hmm. deaths in my family throughout the year, people very close to me, and some separation of family members. So, you know, like a lot of the folks that I've assisted over the years, those are some common things. What makes my situation different than many of the people that I've served is that I have a lot of deep relationships in my life, and I have a lot of supportive family and friends, and that makes all the difference. It struck me that after an 8-year run, this is a good time for me to take some time off and and kind of reflect and do some writing and you know, kind of set a course for myself going forward that probably has me doing something a little bit different.
Can you tell me about who will be taking over after you have left until they find that new executive director?
Yes. So Angie Grillo is the interim executive director, and she was my chief of staff for several years. And she's a tremendous leader, wonderfully gifted person. She has decades of experience in talent management and human resources and project management and leading people, equipping leaders, really mentoring people, you know, everything it, in my opinion, that is good for a leader of an organization.
Do you know kind of what the organization is looking for in an executive director?
First and foremost, the leader has to be committed to grow in their own faith life and committed to the gospel of Jesus Christ, and to, again, be very attentive to the particular needs of people in great need, particularly people who are homeless and people who are you know, experiencing great loss in their lives.
Well, thank you, Michael Vanderberg, for coming in to talk about your time with St. Vincent de Paul Society of Dayton. Is there anything else you would want to share with our listeners before we close out?
We're able to do what we do at St. Vincent because of the support of the community. And it's been a 100 years of trust and volunteering and financial support that has brought that together. And when surprises happened, like the tornadoes, for example, we were prepared to pivot and respond. And that was because the community is there for us. And so I would encourage anybody listening to consider being involved themselves.
WISO's Shea Frank speaking with exiting executive director of the St. Vincent de Paul Society of Dayton, Michael Vanderberg. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend. This week in Veterans Voices, Army veteran Gladys Lawrence has discovered painting, drawing, and creative expression through Ohio's VA Whole Health Program, finding healing through multiple art forms. Here's our series host, Zach Sliver.
For Army veteran and multifaceted artist Gladys Lawrence, the military was a practical choice, a way to work rather than a calling.
What led me to join is that I got out of college during a time of really pronounced unemployment in the South, especially among Blacks. So I really went in the military for a job. So my military time was really spent just trying to find a fit for Gladys. I never did find that good fit, you know, but it was a good experience. It helped me. And you know, it was good to be working. I think one of the biggest, when I initially got out of the military, I noticed that in the military, you're willing to do that extra. You're willing to go that little extra. And it was a little disappointing not seeing it in the quote unquote outside world. You see what I'm saying? It was a mission. It was higher.
The Ohio Department of Veterans Services Whole Health Program offers creative therapies alongside traditional medical care. During the COVID period, Gladys took an online painting and drawing class through the program, a new experience for her that, in her view, went quite well.
I think my teacher didn't think it was quite a success, but I mean, it set a spark for me. Within drawing, I really found that I love reductions, where you take the charcoal dust and you lift out. I love that meditative, slow process. I mean, I really enjoyed it, and I just started taking one art class after another. I'm trying to do a review in my head of the different arts. let me write down, like, because I do so much. Okay, I dance, dabble at the piano, the guitar. I write, I do storytelling. Sometimes it's the writing not happening, I go paint. If I don't feel like painting, I can pick up, go to guitar or the piano. You know, in the military, you don't really give up. You just go to the next thing. I don't give up. It's given me a voice and a purpose. You know, I feel like I still got a message. You know, I'm a vet. I've, like many of my vets, you know, many of us have gone through a lot of trauma in our lives. Over time, I kind of felt like I was kind of disconnected. The arts are helping me connect with people in new ways. It just seemed like there are more possibilities. And I think maybe the military gears you that to more options. The arts have been healing for a lot of vets. That's the only way I can put it. It's healing. It really is. We need the arts. We really do.
Veterans Voices is presented by WrightPath Credit Union. Additional support comes from the Dayton Ombudsman Veterans Transition Team and Montgomery County Veterans Service Commission. Veterans Voices is produced here at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks so much for sharing your weekend with us. And sharing some studio space with us is WYSO's digital editor, Caitlin Schrader. Caitlin, welcome to the studios.
Jerry, it is so good to be here talking to you. I'm excited to talk about today the some of our top stories of 2025.
Yeah, our digital presence is something that we've really pushed hard to increase this year.
That's right. We want to be, you know, public media that's accessible. And part of accessible is just being there however you consume your news. You know, the newsletter, the web, the streaming, Instagram. I'm trying to always be out there. I'm even on Reddit a lot.
Yeah. So let's get to some of our most viewed stories online.
That's right. So when I'm looking through our top 10 most viewed stories for this year, our top story this year was actually about a loss of a federal grant that supports community gardens and community food. So there was a Department of Agriculture grant that was canceled this year that allowed food banks to buy food directly from farmers, ranchers, producers in local places. And so there was a lot of interest in that kind of news.
The government shutdown didn't help with that. It kind of exacerbated the situation.
Yeah. When you look into some of our specific beats and some of our top stories among topics, like you zoom into we are unique that we have a food and agriculture beat, not sure. A lot of that coverage in Ohio. I would say our second most viewed story in that beat is the impact of soaring demand on food banks and kind of the challenges they faced during the shutdown.
We do a lot of coverage of mm-hmm. food banks and food distribution, certainly here as we geared up toward the holidays. Pretty big response to those stories as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, like I said, I mean, that was the number two story when we looked at it. The number one story was actually, and you're going to have to think back a little bit, was actually bird flu on that topic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. It feels like there's been this year, every week feels like a lifetime. And so it's hard to think back that far. But bird flu was actually the most viewed, engaged, listened to topic in the food and agriculture beat, especially Dark County, you know, the center of Ohio's egg production. And Ohio is in, from some perspectives, this center of egg production in the U.S.
And our food and agriculture reporter, Shay Frank, was a big part of some of the stories you're going to hear. Can we talk about some other beats that WISO covers?
Yeah, absolutely. So along with Shay's very incredible coverage this year, so we've got Adriana Martinez-Smiley. They cover Indigenous Affairs, environment. You can also see the interest in those topics as well. So one of our top stories was about there were more than 2,000 artifacts that were covered at an archaeological site in West Dayton this year. So there was an archaeological investigation of a former Native American settlement, and that concluded earlier this year, and that received a lot of interest. Then when you jump over to the, you know, environment, energy coverage, one of our top stories was actually a really interesting story that Adriana did about old growth forest that somehow survived in Beaver Creek, despite an area that we see a lot of development, a lot of housing, roads, shopping, and it's, you know, defied the odds, stood the test of times, and it got a national recognition. And that story had a lot of interest.
If you can quantify, what was our most listened to story of the year?
Besides the most viewed story, the most actually listened story was one of our podcasts. It was a bonus episode of The Ohio Country, which is, you know, our award-winning podcast of Ohio and the removed tribes who've lived here. So we did a bonus episode where Governor DeWine and First Lady DeWine actually came down to the studio and answered questions with the two hosts of the podcast, Nina Ellis and Chris Welter. They answered a lot of good questions. They got real deep. They went on for about an hour, which is incredible. And that was definitely the most listened to thing we did this year.
Well, so let's look at the year ahead. And what do you think some of the top ongoing stories are that people should keep an eye out for?
Yeah, because something I was thinking about is with some of our top stories, they weren't stories that were tied up with a bow during 2025. Adriana, I think we can expect some more coverage, some more in-depth coverage on PFAS. Sometimes you hear it called forever chemicals. There's some interesting ongoing coverage that's been going on, and they're planning to really dig in a lot deeper next year on some of the topic. Catherine Mobley has done some really excellent coverage of Good Sam Hospital closing.
That's right.
About the reaction to the closing and the levy that passed this November that is putting money that's supposed to be dedicated towards a new hospital. But there's still a lot of questions about what happens next and what practically happens going forward. So she is planning to continue to cover that thread and see what happens in 2026.
We're talking with Caitlin Schrader, WISO's digital editor. And Caitlin, before we turn you loose, what is your assessment overall as you've been looking at the top stories of this year and when what's coming down the pike?
Well, something that I love, so I've been at some different media stations and just familiar with the landscape, and we talk a lot about engagement time. And when I see our audience, I see folks who are reading through to the end, who are hungry for information, who are digging into heavy topics. You know, we're not a media station. We're going to go look through a mugshot gallery. That's not what we do. And when I look at our digital numbers, something that's really rewarding is to see that we are building and sustaining an audience that cares about information, like true information, public good information. And in the internet, a place that has kind of the reputation of being clicky and not always great, these numbers are rewarding.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is when you're looking at digital analytics, you can tell how long people stay on a story.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying WISO listeners actually have an attention span.
Yeah. WISO listeners, I'm seeing folks, our average times show that a lot of people are reading through to the end, even long stories. They're listening, they're engaging, they're sharing. And the stories that are doing that are some of our longer stories, our in-depth stories, our investigations. And that really says something, I think, about our audience. That's something positive.
Caitlin Schrader, thanks so much for sharing this information on WISO Weekend.
Jerry, thank you for having me.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom, putting the chutzpah in Hanukkah.
Support for the Ohio Newsroom comes from Cerity Partners. Cerity Partners' Cleveland-based wealth management practice is a neighbor offering objective advice with national strength and resources. Information available at CerityPartners.com/NPR.
This December, Today from the Ohio Newsroom is going all over Ohio, far and near, to spread some holiday cheer. I'm Claire Roth. This festive Friday, we're taking you to meet a Cincinnati toy maker who's bringing major fun to a minor Jewish holiday. The Ohio Newsroom's Kendall Crawford reports.
Over a decade ago, Neil Hoffman's son spotted an elf on the shelf. You know, those little magic guys that pop up around Christmas time to tell Santa whether children have been naughty or nice? Well, Hoffman's son wanted one. The only problem, the Jewish family didn't celebrate Christmas.
And I kind of made this joke and said, no, man, you can have a mensch on a bench.
It sparked an idea for the former Hasbro employee. What if there was a way to lighten the Jewish winter holiday with more than just a menorah?
We could call it putting the Funica into Hanukkah.
He started a Kickstarter campaign to make the Jewish counterpart to the magical elf. The mensch on a bench wouldn't come with all the same rules as the elf on a shelf. He wouldn't lose his magic if you touched him. And instead of snitching for Santa, the toy would come with a storybook to help kids understand how to be a mensch, the Yiddish word for a good and honorable person.
You know, if you read the book, I tried to make the forced Gumbo Judaism. So, and by that, I mean, he doesn't change things. I didn't want to make Santa Claus, right? I wanted to keep and honor the original story of the Maccabees.
In the Hanukkah story, the Maccabees have fought a war to rededicate a Jewish temple, and they have just a tiny jar of oil to get them through 8 nights. In Hoffman's story, each night that the oil is miraculously still lit,
the mensch says, oh, that's amazing. Let me introduce you to dreidel or latkes or gelt, and all these Jewish traditions get introduced through the book.
The didactic doll was an instant hit, not just for his son. Hoffman sold the first 500 mensches and their respective benches in just 10 days. He wanted to make even more, so he brought his jolly bearded Jewish figure to the ABC show Shark Tank.
Hello, sharks. My name's Neil Hoffman from Cincinnati, Ohio, and I'm here asking for $150,000 for 10%.
Two sharks invested. Hoffman's success on the show sent the toy's popularity to new heights and inspired even more ideas.
So here's just the wall of toys. Starting off in the upper corner, you can see the original...
In Hoffman's home office, dolls in different hues of blue peer out from a shelf.
And as we go through, we have the Mitzvah Moose. It's a blue moose with a menorah for antlers that light up. Next to him is the Judah Maccabee, the super duper Jupiter hero. So
there's also the dreidel dog, the Junicorn, and Saul the singing Snowmensch, who happens to have his very own theme song.
Saul is the Snowmensch, he's a very menschy soul. With a cool
other characters are personal to Hoffman. He created the zebra of Zion, the only Jewish animal in the jungle, after his son talked with him about being the only Jewish person in his class. It might seem frivolous to introduce new characters to a tradition that's thousands of years old, but Hoffman says that the toys are a tangible way to showcase the joy of Judaism.
And that's all we're trying to do, is perpetuate Judaism into the future as more and more families are interfaith and there's more risk of Judaism not being passed down. We're trying to introduce some traditions and some tools that, you know, bring smiles to faces.
Hoffman believes even something as serious as faith can benefit from a little humor. And he's not the only one. He sold over 500,000 of his Hanukkah heroes. For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Kendall Crawford in Cincinnati.
That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you next week.
This is Bird Note. In the depths of winter, when sub-zero temperatures last for months and most lakes and ponds are frozen over, how do birds stay hydrated? Water derived from food alone is not enough, especially since juicy insects are in short supply this time of the year. Instead of flying long distances and losing precious energy in search of liquid water, birds imbibe the frozen water that's all around them. While cedar waxwings sally to catch snowflakes from midair, plenty of other birds, including the red-breasted nuthatch, white-tailed ptarmigan, pileated woodpecker, and Bohemian waxwing, scoop up fresh, powdery snow from the ground, trees, or rooftops. Black-capped chickadees drink the water dripping from icicles. The northern flicker hammers at the icy top layer of snow and eats the tiny shards of ice that chip off. Eating all that ice comes at a cost. It takes energy to convert ice and snow to water and warm it up to the body temperature of a bird. But it may be worth the calories for, say, a red-breasted nuthatch, when the alternative is to break off from the flock in search of liquid water, leaving it exposed to predators such as hawks. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Bird Note, putting a wrap on this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Our theme music is Another Beautiful Day in Paradise, provided by Magnolia Bolthead. This program is also a podcast that you can download and subscribe wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks so much for sharing your weekend with WISO. We've got more features, highlights, conversations coming your way next weekend. Please join us then.